Bell Younger, former Los Angeles District Attorney and now California State Attorney General, attorneys Paul Caruso and Richard Caballero, and promoter Lawrence Schiller. Every aspect of the December 4, 1969 agreement, the taping of Atkins' account, the selling of her story, her grand jury testimony, and her firing of Caballero the day after her meeting with Manson was discussed. Shin's most strenuous cross-examination of the entire trial took place when he had Schiller on the stand. Shin wanted to know exactly how much Susan's story had earned and in which bank accounts every penny was. Shin was to receive Susan's share for representing her. During my cross-examination of these witnesses, I scored a number of significant points. I brought out through Caruso, for example, that during the December 4, 1969 meeting, he had stated that Susan Atkins probably wouldn't testify at the trial because of her fear of Manson. Kenerick, however, scored one of the biggest points for the prosecution. In questioning Caballero, Atkins' former attorney, he asked, "What did Susan Atkins tell you about the language written in blood at these three homes?" Caballero, "I told you not to ask me that question, Irving." Apparently convinced that Caballero was hiding something favorable to his client, Kenerick repeated the question. Caballero sighed and said, "She told me that Charles Manson had wanted to bring on Helter Skelter and it wasn't happening fast enough, and the use of the word pig was for the purpose of making them think that Negroes were committing these crimes, because the Panthers and people like that are the ones that used the name pig to mean the establishment, and that was the whole purpose of it, that Helter Skelter wasn't happening fast enough, and Charlie was going to bring on the ruination of the world, and this is why all the murders were committed." "I asked you not to ask me these questions, Mr. Kenerick." Having failed abysmally in their attempt to sell the copycat motive, the defense now switched to a new tactic. They called a number of psychiatrists to the stand, hoping to establish that LSD had affected the minds of the three female defendants to the extent that they were not responsible for their acts. It was not a real defense, but it could be made to seem a mitigating circumstance which, unless thoroughly rebutted, might tip the scales in favor of life imprisonment. Their first witness, Dr. Andre Tweed, professed to be an expert on LSD, but almost all of his testimony was contrary to that of acknowledged experts in the field. Tweed claimed he knew of one case where a youth, while under LSD, heard voices which told him to kill his mother and his grandmother, and he did just that. On the basis of this single, unidentified case, Tweed concluded that people may perform homicidal acts while under the influence of LSD. It was also his opinion, he said, that LSD probably caused brain damage. On cross-examination, I brought out that Dr. Tweed had only talked to Patricia Krenwinkle for 2 hours. He had not read the trial transcripts or interviewed any of her friends or relatives. He had never done any controlled research in the field of LSD, had only lectured once on the subject, and had written no papers on it. When I asked him why he considered himself an expert, he rather loftily replied, "What is an expert but what the beholder thinks he is from his experience? Many people consider me an expert, so I have accustomed myself to assuming that I am." Question: do you consider Dr. Thomas Ungerleiter of UCLA an expert in LSD? Answer: yes, I do. Question: more than yourself? Answer: I am not in a position to judge that. I will leave that to others. Question: do you consider Dr. Duke Fisher of UCLA an expert in the field of LSD? Answer: yes. I then brought out that the two men had written a paper entitled "The Problems of LSD in Emotional Disorders," in which they concluded that there is no scientific demonstrable evidence of organic brain damage caused by LSD. Tweed now had to admit that was correct, as far as present evidence went. On December 24, 1969, Patricia Krenwinkle had been examined by a Mobile, Alabama psychiatrist, a Dr. Claude Brown. Since Tweed had based his conclusions in part on Brown's report, I was given a copy of it just prior to my cross-examination. It was a bombshell, as my next question to Dr. Tweed indicated. Question. In forming your opinions with respect to Patricia Krenwinkel, did you take into consideration that she told Dr. Brown that on the night of the Tate murders, Charles Manson told her to go along with Tex Watson? After numerous objections and lengthy conferences at the bench, Dr. Tweed admitted that he had considered this. Still later, Patricia Krenwinkel was recalled to the stand, where though she denied the truth of the statement, she admitted that she had told Dr. Brown that this was so. We now had a perfect score. Manson had called Sadie, Katie, and Leslie to the stand in an attempt to exonerate him. Instead, I had now proven that each of the three had previously told others that Manson was behind these murders. There were other surprises in the Brown report. Krenwinkel also told the doctor that she had fled to Mobile because she was afraid of Manson finding her and killing her. Although harmful to Manson, this could only be helpful to Fitzgerald's client, Patricia Krenwinkel. However, it was not Fitzgerald who brought this out, but Keith, after Fitzgerald had concluded his examination. That on the day of the Tate murders, she was coming off an acid trip and wasn't on any drugs that night, and that following the murders, she was always fearful that they would be arrested for what they had done, but Charlie said, "Nobody could touch us." This latter statement proved that Katie was well aware of the consequences of her acts. This was important, since it was obvious from their questions that the defense attorneys were trying to imply that the three female defendants were insane at the time they committed these murders. Under California law, an insanity plea must be entered before the start of the trial. A separate sanity phase is then held after the guilt trial. The defense, however, had not entered such a plea at the proper time. Therefore, in one sense, the question of whether the defendants were sane or insane was irrelevant, since this was not an issue which the jury would have to decide. In another sense, however, it was crucial. If the defense could cause the jury to doubt the sanity of the defendants, this could strongly influence their vote on the penalty they were to pay. Suddenly, I was not only having to prove Manson's guilt all over again, I was also having to prove that the girls were legally sane. In most states, including California, the legal test of insanity is the McNaughton Rule. Among other things, McNaughton provides that if a defendant, as a result of mental disease or defect, does not realize that what he did was wrong, then he is legally insane. It is not enough, however, that he personally believe his acts were not wrong. Were this so, every man would be a law unto himself. For instance, a man could rape a dozen women, say, "I don't think it's wrong to rape," and therefore evade criminal punishment. The clincher is whether he knows that society thinks his actions are wrong. If he does, then he cannot be legally insane. And deliberate acts to avoid detection, such as cutting telephone wires, eradicating prints, changing identities, disposing of incriminating evidence, constitute circumstantial evidence that the defendant knows society views his acts as wrong. Earlier, Dr. Tweed had testified that Patricia Krenwinkel didn't believe these murders were wrong. I now asked him on cross, "In your opinion, when Patricia Krenwinkel was committing these murders, did she believe that society thought it was wrong to do what she was doing?" Answer, "I believe so." Bugliosi, no further questions. On March 4th, Manson trimmed his beard to a neat fork and completely shaved his head, because, he told newsmen, "I am the devil, and the devil always has a bald head." Interestingly enough, this time the three female defendants did not follow Manson's example, nor when he occasionally acted up in court did they parrot him, as they had in the guilt trial. Obviously it had got across to them, albeit belatedly, that such antics only proved Manson's domination. While denying that LSD can cause brain damage, the next witness, psychiatrist Keith Dittman, testified that the drug can have a detrimental effect on a person's personality. He also stated that a person using LSD is more susceptible to the influence of a second party, and that Leslie's use of the drug, plus Manson's influence over her, could have been significant factors in causing her to participate in a homicide. Van Houten, this is all such a big lie. I was influenced by the war in Vietnam and TV. On cross-examination, I got Dittman to concede that not all people react the same to LSD, that it depends upon the personality structure of the person ingesting the drug. I then brought out that Dittman had never examined Leslie. Therefore, not knowing what her personality structure was, he couldn't say what effect, if any, LSD had on her mental state. Nor, turning this around, not having examined her, could he say for certain whether she did or did not have inherent homicidal tendencies. Keith, on redirect, asked Dittman, "What is meant by inherent homicidal tendencies?" Answer, "That a person has, let's say, more than the average human being, a killer instinct." Question, "Psychiatrically speaking, do some people have greater killer instincts than others, in your opinion?" Answer, "Well, some people have a more covert and overt hostility and aggression. In that sense, they are more capable of committing crimes of violence, such as murder." Dr. Dittman had just articulated one of the chief points of the final argument I was preparing to give at the close of the penalty phase. Dr. Joel Fort, the almost legendary hippie doctor of the hate, didn't look the part. The founder of the National Center for Solving Social and Health Problems was 40-ish, dressed conservatively, talked quietly, didn't have long hair. In fact, he was bald. Angered by his testimony, Manson shouted, "If he ever seen a hippie, it was in the street while he was driving by in his car." Manson's anger had good cause. Even on direct, Dr. Fort was more helpful to the prosecution than the defense. The author of one book on drugs and co-author of 11 others, Dr. Fort stated that a drug by itself does not perform a magical transformation. There are many other factors. On cross-examination, I brought out one. Fort said, "It was my feeling, after examining Leslie Van Houten, that Mr. Manson's influence played a very significant role in the commission of the murders." Another very crucial point came out on cross. To negate the defense's new argument that the girls were on LSD during the murders, and therefore less responsible for their acts, I asked Fort, "Isn't it true, Doctor, that people under the influence of LSD do not tend to be violent?" Answer, "That is true." Still attacking the prosecution's theory of Manson's domination, Kenrick asked Fort, "Now, do you know of any cases where someone has... I mean, other than in the Frankenstein type of picture, do you know where someone has sat down and programmed people to go out, let's say, and commit armed robberies, burglaries, assaults? Do you know of any such instances?" Answer, "Yes. In one sense, that is what we do when we program soldiers in a war. The Army uses a peer group technique and the patriotic ideals that are instilled in citizens of a particular country to bring about this pattern of behavior." Dr. Fort was typical of many persons who, though opposed to capital punishment in principle, felt that these murders were so savage and senseless, so totally lacking in mitigating circumstances, that justice demanded that these persons be sentenced to death. I learned this in a conversation with him in the hall outside court, in which he stated that he was extremely unhappy that he had been called to testify for the defense in this case. Greatly concerned about the stain the Manson family had cast on all young people, Dr. Fort offered to testify for the prosecution when I brought Charles Tex Watson to trial, an offer which I later accepted. It was in just such a hallway interview that I discovered how potentially damaging to the defense their next witness could be. Learning that Keith intended to call Dr. Joel Simon Hockman during the afternoon session, I cut my lunch hour short so I could spend a half hour interviewing the psychiatrist. To my amazement, I learned that Maxwell Keith hadn't even interviewed his own witness. He was calling him to the stand cold. Had he talked to him for just 5 minutes, Keith would never have called Hockman. for the doctor, who had interviewed Leslie, felt that the use of LSD wasn't an important influence on her. Rather, he felt there was something very seriously wrong with Leslie Van Houten. In his testimony and the psychiatric report he wrote following the examination, Dr. Hochman called Leslie Van Houten a spoiled little princess who was unable to suffer frustration and delay of gratification. From childhood on, she'd had extreme difficulties with impulse control. When she didn't get her way, she went into rages, for example, beating her adopted sister with a shoe. From a position of overall perspective, Hochman noted, it is quite clear that Leslie Van Houten was a psychologically loaded gun which went off as a consequence of the complex intermeshing of highly unlikely and bizarre circumstances. Hochman confirmed something I had long suspected. Of the three female defendants, Leslie Van Houten was the least committed to Charles Manson. She listened to Manson's talk of philosophy, but it wasn't her trip. Nor could she get that into Charlie sexually, and that bothered her a lot. "I couldn't get it on with Charlie like I could with Bobby," she said. According to Hochman, Leslie was obsessed with beauty. Bobby was beautiful. Charles was not, physically. Charles was short. That is something that always turned me off. Yet she killed at his command. Keith asked Hochman, "Doctor, did you ask her whether or not Mr. Manson, during her association with him, had any influence over her in her thought process and in her conduct and activity?" Answer, "She denies it, but I don't buy that." Question, "Why don't you buy that?" Answer, "Well, I don't understand why she would stay on the scene that long if there was nothing there for her, on some unconscious basis." As I'd observe in my final argument, many came to Spawn Ranch, but only a few stayed. Those who did so because they found the black-hearted medicine Manson was peddling very palatable. According to Hochman, in talking to him, Leslie professed a kind of primitive Christianity, love for the world, acceptance of all things. And I asked her, "Well, professing that, how can it be you would murder someone?" She said, "Well, that was something inside of me, too." Maxwell Keith should have stopped right there. Instead, he asked Hochman, "How do you interpret that?" Answer, "I think it's rather realistic. I think that in reality it was something inside of her, despite her chronic denial of the emotional aspects of herself, that a rage was there." Nor did Keith leave it at that. He now asked, "When you say a rage was there, what do you mean by that?" Answer, "In my opinion, it would take a rage, an emotional reaction, to kill someone. I think it is unquestionable that that feeling was inside of her." Question, "Bearing in mind that she had never seen or heard of Mrs. LaBianca, in your opinion, there was some hate in her when this occurred?" Answer, "Well, I think it would make it easier for her not to know Mrs. LaBianca. It is hard to kill someone that you have good feelings towards. I don't think there was anything specific about Mrs. LaBianca." Let me make myself clear. Mrs. LaBianca was an object, a blank screen upon which Leslie projected her feelings, much as a patient projects his feelings on an analyst whom he doesn't know. Feelings towards her mother, her father, toward the establishment. I think she was a very angry girl for a long time, a very alienated girl for a long time, and the anger and rage was associated with that. Hochman was articulating one of the main points of my final summation, namely that Leslie, Sadie, Katie, and Tex had a hostility and rage within them that pre-existed Charles Manson. They were different from Linda Kasabian, Paul Watkins, Brooks Poston, Juan Flynn, and TJ. When Manson asked them to kill for him, each said no. Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Leslie Van Houten said yes. So there had to be something special about these people that caused them to kill. Some kind of inner flaw. Apart from Charlie. Though he had badly damaged his own case, Keith had tried to put the hat on Manson. Fitzgerald, in his examination of Hockman, did just the opposite. He sought to minimize the importance of Manson's influence over Leslie. Asking Hockman what Manson's influence actually was, he received this reply. His ideas, his presence, the role he played in his relationship to her, served to reinforce a lot of her feelings and attitudes. It served to reinforce and give her a way of continuing her general social alienation, her alienation from the establishment. Question. So, really, all you were saying is that A, Manson could possibly have had some influence, and B, if he did have some influence, it would only contribute to the lowering of her restraints on her impulsiveness, is that correct? Answer. Yes. Question. So any influence Manson had on Leslie Van Houten, in terms of your professional opinion, is tenuous at best, is that correct? There was no meaningful dichotomy between Leslie Van Houten and Fitzgerald's client, Patricia Krenwinkel. Both young girls had joined the family, submitted to Manson's domination, and ultimately murdered for him. In trying to establish that Manson was not responsible for causing Leslie to kill, Fitzgerald was at the same time establishing that Manson wasn't responsible for Katie's killing either. Hockman's reply badly hurt not only Leslie, but Katie and Sadie as well. Answer. Let me give you another example that may make it clearer. Suppose someone comes in and says, "Let's eat the whole apple pie." Obviously, your temptation is stimulated by the suggestion, but your final decision on whether or not to eat the whole pie or just one piece comes out of you. So the other person is influential, but it is not a final arbiter or decider of that situation. Someone can tell you to shoot someone, but your decision to do that comes from inside you. Kenrick, when his turn came, picked up the scent. And so you are telling us, then, in layman's language, that when someone takes a knife and stabs, the decision to do that is a personal decision. Answer. In the ultimate analysis, it is. Question. It is a personal decision of the person who does the stabbing. Answer. Yes. Ironically, Kenrick and I were now on the same side. Both of us were seeking to prove that, even independent of Manson, these girls had murder within them. Manson was very impressed by Hockman, and at first wanted to be interviewed by him. I was relieved, however, when he later abandoned the idea. I wasn't greatly worried about Manson conning Hockman. But even if Hockman didn't buy Manson's story, Kenrick would make sure he repeated it on the stand. Thus, using Hockman as a conduit, Manson could get almost everything he wanted before the jury without being subject to my cross-examination. Hockman found in all three girls much evidence in their history of early alienation, of early antisocial or deviant behavior. Even before joining the family, Leslie had more emotional problems than the average person. Sadie actively sought to be everything her father warned her not to be. She thinks now, in retrospect, Hockman noted, that even without Charles Manson, she would have ended up in jail for manslaughter or assault with a deadly weapon. Katie first had sex at 15. She never saw the boy again, and she suffered tremendous guilt because of the experience. Manson eradicated that guilt. He also, in letting her join the family, gave her the acceptance she desperately craved. Of the three, Hockman felt Sadie had a little more remorse than the other two. She often talked of wishing her life were over. Yet he also noted, one is struck by the absence of a conventional sense of morality or conscience in this girl. And, he testified, she does not seem to manifest any evidence of discomfort or anxiety about her present circumstances, or her conviction and possible death sentence. On the contrary, she seemed to manifest a remarkable peacefulness and self-acceptance in her present state. According to Hockman, all three girls denied any sense of guilt whatever about anything, and he felt that intellectually, they actually believed there is no right or wrong, that morality is a relative thing. However, I, as a psychiatrist, know that you cannot rationally do away with the feelings that exist on the irrational, unconscious level. You cannot tell yourself that killing is okay intellectually when you have grown up all your life feeling that killing is wrong. In short, Hockman believed that as human beings the girls felt some guilt deep down inside, even though they consciously suppressed it. Keith asked Hockman, "In your opinion, doctor, would Leslie be susceptible or respond to intensive therapy?" Answer, "Possibly." Question, "In other words, you don't feel that she is such a lost soul that she could never be rehabilitated?" Answer, "No, I don't think she is that lost a soul, no." To a psychiatrist, no one is beyond redemption. This is essential, standard testimony. Yet only one of the defense attorneys, Maxwell Keith, asked the question, and then only on redirect. Earlier I'd brought out that Hockman had only the word of the girls that they were on LSD either night. I now asked him, "Have you ever read a reported case in the literature of LSD of any individual who committed murder while under the influence of LSD?" Answer, "No. Suicide, but not murder." As I'd later ask the jury, could Watson, Atkins, Krenwinkel, and Van Houten, all four, be exceptions? A large portion of Hockman's testimony had dealt with the mental states of the three girls. Susan Atkins was suffering from a diagnosable condition, he said, an early childhood deprivation syndrome which had resulted in a hysterical personality type. This was not legal insanity as defined by McNaughton. Leslie Van Houten was an immature, unusually impulsive person who tended to act spontaneously without reflection. Nor was this legal insanity as defined by McNaughton. In his report on Krenwinkel, Dr. Claude Brown, the Mobile psychiatrist, had stated that, "At the time I saw Miss Krenwinkel, she showed a schizophrenic reaction." He added, however, that, "I do not state with any certainty that this psychosis existed at the time of the alleged murders." Schizophrenia may be legal insanity as defined by McNaughton, but Dr. Brown's opinion was qualified, and when Fitzgerald asked Dr. Hockman if, on the basis of his examination of Krenwinkel, he agreed that she was or had been schizophrenic, Hockman replied, "I would say no." It remained to bring these points across to the jury in terms they could easily understand. On re-cross-examination, I had Hockman define the word psychotic. He replied that it meant a loss of contact with reality. I then asked him, "At the present time, doctor, do you feel any of these three female defendants are psychotic?" Answer, "No." Question, "In your opinion, do you feel that any of these three female defendants have ever been psychotic?" Answer, "No." Bugliosi, "May I approach the witness, Your Honor? I want to ask the witness a question privately." The court, "Yes, you may." I had already questioned Dr. Hockman once about this, but I wanted to be absolutely certain of his reply. Once I had received it, I returned to the counsel table and asked him a number of unrelated questions so the jury wouldn't know what we had been talking about. I then gradually worked up to the big one. Question. The term insanity, doctor, you are familiar with that term, of course. Answer, yes. Question. Basically, you define the word insanity to be the layman's synonym for psychotic? Answer. I would say that the word insanity is used generally to mean psychotic. Question. Then from a psychiatric standpoint, I take it that in your opinion, none of these three female defendants are presently insane, nor have they ever been insane. Is that correct? Answer. That is correct. As far as the psychiatric testimony was concerned, with Hockman's reply, the ballgame was over. The defense called only three more witnesses during the penalty trial, all hardcore family members. Each was on the stand only a short time, but their testimony, particularly that of the first witness, was as shocking as anything that had gone before. Catherine Gillies, whose grandmother owned Myers Ranch, parroted the family line. "Charlie never led anyone. There was never any talk of a race war. These murders were committed to free Bobby Beausoleil." Coldly, matter-of-factly, the 21-year-old girl testified that on the night of the LaBianca murders, I followed Katie to the car, and I asked her if I could go with her. Linda, Leslie, and Sadie were all in the car, and they said that they had plenty of people to do what they were going to do, and that I didn't need to go. On direct examination by Kenrick, Kathy stated, "You know, I am willing to kill for a brother. We all are." Question: What do you mean by that? Answer: In other words, to get a brother out of jail, I would kill. I would have killed that night, except I did not go. Question: What prevented you from going with them, if anything? Answer: Just the fact that they didn't need me. Apparently Fitzgerald hoped to soften the harshness of her reply when he asked her, "Have you killed anybody to get someone out of jail?" With a strange little smile, Kathy turned her head and, looking directly at the jury, replied, "Not yet." Kathy had testified on direct examination that Katie had told her about the Tate-LaBianca murders. On cross-examination, I asked her, "When Katie told you that they had murdered these people, did this disturb you at all?" Answer: Actually, it had very little effect on me, because I knew why they had done it. Question: So it didn't upset you? Answer: No, it definitely didn't upset me. Question: You didn't decide that you would rather not continue living with murderers? Answer: Obviously not. Question: Were you upset that you didn't get to go along with them? Answer: I wanted to go. Mary Brunner, first member of the Manson family, claimed that the police had told her that she would be charged with murder if she did not implicate Manson in the Hinman slaying. She now repudiated this testimony and further denied ever being at the Hinman residence. Keith brought out that Mary Brunner had testified both in the second trial of Bobby Beausoleil and before the Hinman grand jury, and neither time did she say anything about Leslie Van Houten being present when Hinman was killed. I had no questions for her. The point was made. Brenda McCann was recalled to the stand to testify that on the nights of the Tate and LaBianca murders, she had seen Manson sleeping with Stephanie Schramm in Devil's Canyon. The groundwork for my cross-examination of Brenda had been laid 15 months before. I impeached her with her testimony before the grand jury when she stated that she couldn't remember where she or Manson was on either night. Brenda was the last witness. She completed her testimony on Tuesday, March 16, 1971. That afternoon, after a number of delays, Kenrick, for example, refused to stipulate that Gary Hinman was dead. The defense rested. Wednesday, we worked on the jury instructions, and on Thursday, the trial entered its final stage. All that now remained were the arguments, the deliberations, and the verdict. March 18th to 29th, 1971. My opening argument in the penalty trial was brief, lasting less than 10 minutes. As with all my arguments during the trial, Manson decided to sit this one out in the lockup. The psychology behind this was obvious. He didn't want the jury focusing on him when I discussed him. I began by saying I am not going to address myself to the frantic effort by the three female defendants and the defense witnesses to make it look like Charles Manson wasn't involved in these murders. I am sure all of you clearly saw that they were lying on that witness stand to do what they could for their god, Charles Manson. Well, Charles Manson has already been convicted. He has already been convicted of 7 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of conspiracy to commit murder. The difficulty in your decision, as I see it, is not whether these defendants deserve the death penalty, ladies and gentlemen. In view of the incredibly savage, barbaric, and inhuman murders they committed, the death penalty is the only proper verdict. I then stated the very heart of my argument. If this case were not a proper case for the imposition of the death penalty, no case ever would be. In view of what they did, life imprisonment would be the greatest gift, the greatest charity, the greatest handout, as it were, ever given. The difficulty in your decision, as I see it, is whether you will have the fortitude to return verdicts of death against all four defendants. The defense attorneys, I anticipated, would beg for their clients' lives. This was not only commendable, I told the jury, it was also understandable, just as it was understandable that they argued during the guilt phase that their clients were not involved in these murders, even though during the penalty phase the three female defendants took the stand and said, yes, we were involved. There was absolutely no reason for these defendants to viciously and inhumanly snuff out the lives of these seven human beings, I noted. There were no mitigating circumstances. These defendants are not human beings, ladies and gentlemen. Human beings have a heart and a soul. No one with a heart and a soul could have done what these defendants did to these seven victims. These defendants are human monsters, human mutations. There is only one proper ending to the Tate-LaBianca murder trial, I concluded. Verdicts of death for all four defendants. Kenrick stipulated at the start of his argument that Mr. Manson is not all good. However, he continued, Mr. Manson is innocent of these matters that are before us. Why was he on trial then? Kenrick returned to his two favorite themes. Mr. Manson has had quite a share of troubles because of the fact that he likes girls. And he was only brought to trial so someone in the district attorney's office can have a gold star and say, I got Charles Manson. Kenrick's argument stretched over 3 days. It was occasionally ridiculous, as when he said, we can perform a public service for the United States of America by giving these people life, because if there is a revolution, this is the kind of thing that could spark it. It was sometimes unintentionally funny, as when he stated that unlike Patricia Krenwinkel and Leslie Van Houten, Charles Manson has no family to come here to testify. But mostly, he tried to plant little seeds of doubt. Why, if Susan Atkins lied on the stand to absolve Manson, would she have implicated him in the Hinman murder? Wasn't the fact that Manson himself shot Crow to protect the people at Spawn Ranch evidence that he didn't need to order others to act for him? If these girls were lying about Manson's non-involvement in the murders, wouldn't they have also lied and said they had sorrow and remorse? Kenrick only briefly mentioned the copycat motive. He didn't even try to argue it. Instead, he suggested still another alternative motive. But for the fact that at least some of these people, supposedly referring to the Tate victims, were engaged in a narcotic episode of some type, these events would not have taken place. Day Shin, who argued next, fastened on Dr. Hockman's statement that he believed these girls had subconscious, if not conscious, remorse. As for Susan, she is still young, Shin argued. She is only 22 years old. I believe there is still a hope of rehabilitating her. Maybe someday she may be rehabilitated to the extent that she may finally realize what she has done was not right. I believe that she deserves the chance, an opportunity, so that maybe someday she may be released and live the rest of her life out of prison. This was very bad strategy on Shin's part, implying that if Susan Atkins was given life imprisonment, she might someday be released on parole. By law, the prosecution can't argue this. It is so prejudicial to the defendant. Of the four defense attorneys, Maxwell Keith gave the best opening argument. He was also the only one who really attempted to rebut my contentions. Mr. Bugliosi tells you that if the death penalty is not appropriate in this case, it would never be appropriate. Well, I wonder if it ever is appropriate. Mr. Bugliosi read to you at the close of his argument on the guilt phase the roll call of the dead. Let me read to you now, ladies and gentlemen, the roll call of the living dead. Leslie, Sadie, Katie, Squeaky, Brenda, Uish, Sandy, Kathy, Gypsy, Tex, Clem, Mary, Snake, and no doubt many more. These lives, and the lives of these three young women in particular, have been so damaged that it is possible in some cases their destruction is beyond repair. I hope not, but it is possible. Leslie Van Houten, he strongly argued, was capable of rehabilitation. She should be studied, not killed. I am not asking you to forgive her, although to forgive is divine. I am asking you to give her the chance to redeem herself. She deserves to live. What she did was not done by the real Leslie. Let the Leslie of today die. She will, slowly, and maybe painfully. And let the Leslie, as she once was, live again. Nowhere in Paul Fitzgerald's argument, which followed, did he state or even imply that Manson was responsible for what had happened to Patricia Krenwinkel. Patricia Krenwinkel is 23 years old, Fitzgerald observed. With 365 days in the year, there are approximately 8,400 days in 23 years, and approximately 200,000 hours in her lifetime. The perpetration of these offenses took, at best, approximately 3 hours. Is she to be judged solely on what occurred during 3 of 200,000 hours? Just before court commenced on March 23rd, I walked over to the water cooler. Manson, in the nearby lockup, called out to me rather loudly, "If I get the death penalty, there is going to be a lot of bloodletting, because I am not going to take it." Both the court clerk and Steve Kay overheard the remark. Kay intemperately rushed out of the courtroom and repeated it to the press. Learning of this, I asked the reporters not to print it. The Herald Examiner wouldn't agree, and it broke the story with a banner headline, "Manson Death Threat. Warns of terror if doomed to die." Before this, however, Judge Older, made aware of what had happened, decided that rather than wait to the close of arguments, he would sequester the jury immediately. In my final argument, I rebutted point by point the earlier defense contentions. For example, the defense had claimed that Linda got her story from listening to the Susan Atkins tapes. Why would Linda need to listen to the tapes, I asked, when she was present both nights? Kenrick had told the jury that if they returned death penalty verdicts, they would be killers. This was a very heavy argument. As support, he cited the fifth commandment, "Thou shalt not kill." In answer, I told the jury that most biblical scholars and theologians interpret the original language to mean, "Thou shalt not commit murder," which is exactly how it appears in the New English Bible, dated 1970. The Ten Commandments appear in Exodus chapter 20, I noted. What Kenrick did not mention, I observed, is that the very next chapter authorizes the death penalty. Exodus 21 verse 12 reads, "Whoever strikes a man a mortal blow must be put to death," while verse 14 of the same chapter reads, "When a man kills another, after maliciously scheming to do so, you must take him even from my altar and put him to death." Kenrick argued that there was no domination. In addition to all the evidence during the guilt trial, I observed during the penalty trial, when Atkins, Krenwinkel, and Van Houten played the part of the sacrificial lamb and admitted their participation in these murders, and then lied on that witness stand and said that Manson wasn't involved, the fact that they were willing to lie on that witness stand just proves all the more Manson's domination over them. As for the other family witnesses, Squeaky, Sandy, and the others, all of them sounded like a broken record on that witness stand. They all have the same thought. They use the same language. Each one was a carbon copy of the other. They are all still totally subservient and subject to Charles Manson. They are his extant slaves. I came now to the copycat motive. My objective was to completely demolish it, yet not dwell on it so long that it would seem like I was giving it credence. "It is really laughable, ladies and gentlemen," I began, "the way the three female defendants and the defense witnesses sought to take the hat off Charles Manson. They had to come up with a motive for these murders other than helter-skelter. Why? Because no less than 10 witnesses during the guilt trial had irrevocably connected Manson with helter-skelter, so they certainly could not say from that witness stand that the motive for these murders was helter-skelter. If they said that, they would be saying, yes, Charles Manson masterminded these murders. So they came up with the copycat motive. I could give you between 20 and 30 reasons why it's obvious that this nonsensical story of the defense was fabricated out of whole cloth, but I won't take up your time with it, and I am not going to insult your intelligence. I did point out a few. Linda Kasabian testified during the penalty trial that she had never heard anyone discuss committing these murders to free Bobby Beausoleil. Gary Hinman was stabbed not more than 4 times. Wojtek Frankowski was stabbed 51 times. Rosemary LaBianca 41 times. Lino LaBianca 26 times. Rather a great difference if these were copycat slayings. And if these murders were to be carbon copies, why weren't the words political piggy used at the Tate and LaBianca residences? And why no bloody paw print at the latter two houses? The most powerful evidence demolishing this ridiculous motive, I noted, was that as early as February 1969, long before there was any Hinman murder to copy, long before there were any words political piggy to copy, Manson told Brooks Poston and other family members, including all of his co-defendants, that, quoting Poston, he said a group of real blacks would come out of the ghettos and do an atrocious crime in the richer sections of Los Angeles and other cities. They would do an atrocious murder with stabbing, killing, cutting bodies to pieces, smearing blood on the walls, writing pigs on the walls. Writing pigs on the walls, I repeated. So writing pig at the Tate and LaBianca residences was simply a part of Manson's blueprint for starting Helter Skelter, not an effort to copy the Hinman murder. Incidentally, I observed, Mr. Kennerick never did try to explain to you why the words Helter Skelter were printed in blood on the refrigerator door at the LaBianca residence. What does Helter Skelter have to do with freeing Bobby Beausoleil or an alleged $1,000 MDA burn at the Tate residence? Absolutely nothing, that's what. The words Helter Skelter were found printed in blood on the LaBianca refrigerator door because all of the evidence at this trial shows beyond all doubt that Helter Skelter was the principal reason for these savage murders. Yes, I admitted. There is a connection between the Hinman murder and the Tate LaBianca murders. But it was not this silly Bobby Beausoleil nonsense. Here is the connection. Mr. Manson not only ordered the Tate LaBianca murders, he also ordered the Hinman murder. That is the connection. As for Susan Atkins' claim that Linda Kasabian masterminded these murders, I noted that not until the penalty phase did she say anything about this, and then all of a sudden Linda Kasabian is Charles Manson. I noted some of the reasons why this was preposterous, among them the ridiculousness of the docile, subservient Linda taking over the leadership of the family in just 1 month. Only one person ordered these murders, ladies and gentlemen, and his initials are C.M. He also has an A.K.A., J.C., and he is in that lockup right now listening to me. The most preposterous thing about all this was that supposedly for 1.5 years both Sadie and Gypsy kept this secret in their perjurous bosoms. They not only didn't tell the other members of the family, they didn't even tell Manson's attorney, though both testified they loved and would willingly die for Charlie. And why didn't they tell him about this motive? Because it didn't exist. It was recently fabricated. As for Manson's alibi, that he was with Stephanie Schramm in Devil's Canyon on both of these nights, isn't it strange that all of Mr. Manson's extant slaves have testified to this during the penalty trial, and the very person, Stephanie Schramm, whom they claim Manson was with, testified that Manson was not with her? I then addressed myself to the issue of whether the four defendants should receive the death penalty. The strongest argument that can be made in support of capital punishment is, I feel, deterrence, that it may save additional lives. Unfortunately, under California law, the prosecution could not argue deterrence, only retribution. These weren't typical murders, ladies and gentlemen. This was a one-sided war where unspeakable atrocities were committed. If all of these defendants don't receive the death penalty, the typical first-degree murderer only deserves 10 days in the county jail. As for Fitzgerald's contention that killing these defendants would not bring the 7 victims back to life, if we were to accept that line of reasoning, no one would ever be punished for any crime, since punishing a person does not remove the fact that the crime was committed. For example, don't punish a man for arson, because the punishment is not going to rebuild the building. In California, if a defendant is 17 years of age or younger, he or she cannot be sentenced to death. Though Fitzgerald repeatedly called the 3 female defendants children, I reminded the jury that Leslie was 21, Susan 22, Katie 23. They are adults by any standard, and completely responsible for their acts. In regard to the defense contention that the 3 female defendants were insane, I reminded the jury that Dr. Hockman, the only psychiatrist to examine all 3, said they are not and have never been insane. Dr. Hockman testified that we are all capable of killing, I noted. He did not say that we are all capable of murder. There is a vast difference between killing, as in justifiable homicide, self-defense, or defense of others, and murder. And no one can convince me, ladies and gentlemen, that all of us are capable of murdering strangers for no reason whatsoever, like these 3 female defendants did. It takes a special type of person to do what they did. It takes a person who places no value on the life of a fellow human being. True, Watson, Atkins, Krenwinkel, and Van Houten committed these murders because Charles Manson told them to, but they would never have committed these murders in 1,000,000 years if they did not already have murder in their guts, in their system. Manson merely told them to do what they were already capable of doing. Moreover, there was no evidence that Manson forced Watson and the girls to murder for him. In fact, the inference is that they wanted to go along. That seemed to be the general feeling in the family. Witness the statement of Kathy Gillies. Witness Susan Atkins telling Juan Flynn, "We're going to get some fucking pigs." Does that sound like someone who is being forced to go out? Manson ordered the murders, but Watson and the 3 girls personally committed them because they wanted to. Make no mistake about that. If they did not want to murder these victims, all they had to do was not do it. I examined now the backgrounds of the 3 girls. Like the other female members of the family, they had one common denominator among them. It was obvious that each of them had a revulsion, an antipathy, a seething feeling of disgust for society, for their own parents. Each of the 3 girls had dropped out of society before even meeting Charles Manson. Each had taken LSD and other drugs before meeting Manson, and each had rejected her real family before meeting Manson. Looking right at juror Jean Roseland, who had 2 teenage daughters, I said, "Don't confuse them with the girl next door type. These 3 female defendants had repudiated and renounced their very families and society before they ever met Charles Manson. In fact, it was precisely because they had contemptuously disavowed and rejected their families and society that they ended up with Charles Manson. That is the very reason. Manson was simply the catalyst, the moving force that translated their pre-existing disgust and hatred for society and human beings into violence." I anticipated an argument that I felt Maxwell Keith might give. "The thought certainly may enter your mind that as wicked and as vicious as these 3 female defendants are, by comparison to Charles Manson, they are nowhere as wicked and vicious as he is. Therefore, let's give Manson the death penalty, and these 3 female defendants life imprisonment." The only problem with that type of approach is that these female defendants are given credit, as it were, because of Manson's extreme wickedness and viciousness. Under that type of reasoning, if Adolf Hitler were Charles Manson's co-defendant, Manson should receive life imprisonment because of the indescribably evil Adolf Hitler. Rather than compare the three female defendants with Manson, I told the jury, they should evaluate the conduct of each of the defendants and determine whether it warranted the imposition of the death penalty. I then went into the acts of each, starting with Manson, enumerating one by one the reasons they deserved death rather than life. One question the jury would surely ask, I noted, was, why no remorse? The answer was simple. Manson and his co-defendants like to kill human beings. That is why they have no remorse. As Paul Watkins testified, death is Charlie's trip. I came to the end of my argument. Now the defense attorneys want you to give these defendants a break. Did these defendants give the seven victims in this case a break? Now the defense attorneys want you to give their clients another chance. Did these defendants give the seven victims in this case any chance at all? Now the defense attorneys want you to have mercy on their clients. Did these defendants have any mercy at all on the seven victims in this case when they begged and pleaded for their lives? I then reminded the jurors that 9 months earlier, during voir dire, each had told me he would be willing to vote death if he felt this was a proper case. I reiterated, if the death penalty is to mean anything in the state of California other than two empty words, this is a proper case. I concluded, on behalf of the people of the state of California, I can't thank you enough for the enormous public service you have rendered as jurors in this very long, historic trial. That night, after dinner, I said to Gail, there must be something I have to do tonight. But there wasn't. For a year and a half, 7 days a week, I had been totally immersed in the case. Now all I could do was listen to the closing arguments of the defense attorneys and wait until the jury reached its verdict. Kenrick began by implying that perhaps I had poisoned the glass of water on the lectern, and ended, more than a day later, by reading chapter after chapter from the New Testament. Now, this being the Easter season, there is an analogy here between Mr. Manson. This may sound at first blush to be ridiculous, and we are not suggesting that Mr. Manson is the deity or Christ-like or anything like that, but how can we know? Judge Older, who had several times warned Kenrick that he had exhausted all relevant rebuttal, finally brought his sermon to an end at the point of resurrection. Chin spent his time attacking the DA's office, and in particular me. Miss Atkins was drowning without friends, and she saw Mr. Bugliosi with an oar. She said, oh, here comes help now. Miss Atkins reached out for that oar. And what do you think Mr. Bugliosi did? He hit her over the head with the oar. Keith delivered a strong argument against the death penalty itself. Before this, however, he said, now strangely, or perhaps not so strangely, I accepted wholeheartedly certain areas of Mr. Bugliosi's argument. I accept his exposition to you that Mr. Manson dominated these girls and ordered the homicides. I accept that the free Bobby Beausoleil motive is nonsense. I accept his telling you that you shouldn't hold the Hinman murder against Leslie. I accept his argument that Leslie's testimony and the testimony of the other girls in this case shows Mr. Manson's domination and influence still persists and is all-pervasive. To deny these things, Keith said, would be to deny the evidence. Thus, Keith became the first and only defense attorney to accuse Manson of these murders. Keith, however, said that he did not agree that any of the defendants should receive the death penalty, not even Charles Manson, for in his opinion, Keith said, Mr. Manson is insane, and in instilling his thoughts into the minds of the three female defendants, he had also infected them with his madness. Keith concluded, give Leslie the chance for redemption, to which she is entitled. Remember, Linda Kasabian cut the umbilical cord, in Mr. Bugliosi's words, that tied her to Manson and his family. Give Leslie the chance to do the same. Give her life. I thank you. Fitzgerald read a short argument, at the end of which he began describing in detail how the three female defendants would be executed in the gas chamber at San Quentin Prison if the jury returned verdicts of death. This was improper argument, and I objected. When we approached the bench, Paul literally begged Judge Alder to let him proceed. This is extremely important. I can't impress on the court how important it is. Because he was so desperate, I decided to back off, agreeing not to object if he would describe this.